Hey, welcome to the Growth.me Summary of The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell. This book explores how stories shape our perception of the world and why myths continue to be relevant in providing direction to our lives even in modern times. Joseph Campbell will explain universal lessons that come from myths, like how we can discover our personal hero's journey and follow our bliss. Looking at the online reviews for this book, on Amazon it has 4.7 stars, and on Goodreads it has 4.3 stars. So overall, reviews say this book is outstanding, with many people finding the book to be insightful, eye-opening, and a wealth of knowledge. But there were some who disliked the author's occasional use of mystical language, like when he talks about the great mystery of life. So imagine if I told you that some of our most beloved characters, like Harry Potter casting spells in Hogwarts, or Frodo Baggins trekking through Middle-earth, or even Luke Skywalker swinging his lightsaber, they all play out the same type of hero's journey, just in different cloaks, or in Luke's case, Jedi robes. And here's something even more mind-blowing. What if I told you that same pattern can even be found in the most popular heroes of ancient times, like Hercules and Odysseus, and even reaching into religious figures like Jesus and Buddha? Well, Joseph Campbell spent his entire life studying myths from around the world, and he came to believe there was a single universal monomyth that lied underneath all the most powerful narratives throughout history and even now. And he called that the hero's journey. That means the same pattern shows up in stories over and over and over again. And so this hero's journey must really resonate with something very deep inside of us, which is our common humanity regardless of our culture. I think The Power of Myth, this book also provides a compelling counter-argument to popular atheist voices of recent times, who have often mocked religion as being foolish or childish. So Joseph Campbell demonstrates there is invaluable wisdom that is hidden within the world's myths and religions, even if they may not at first appear to make rational sense on the surface. Myths have the power to guide our life's direction and purpose in a meaningful way. They can structure the shared life in our communities and tribes, and they have for thousands of years. And myths can even open our hearts to the great mystery of the universe, says Joseph Campbell. Those parts of reality that can't really be grasped with our intellect or physical senses. And okay, I know that's getting a little too mystical for some of us, but maybe we can also remember what one British geneticist named J.B.S. Haldane once said. Not only is the universe stranger than we suppose, it is stranger than we can suppose. End quote. So, who was Joseph Campbell? Well, he was an influential professor and writer who spent decades studying the world's myths and religions. In 1949, he wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces, a groundbreaking book in the field of comparative mythology that explained his idea of the hero's journey. That book profoundly influenced George Lucas while making Star Wars, and Joseph Campbell's popularity increased dramatically after a 1988 television interview series, which was also called The Power of Myth. And that was a series of enlightening conversations between him and journalist Bill Moyers, which was later adapted into this book. So they had this 6-hour interview series, but they had over 20 hours of transcripts, so there's a lot more material in this book than in that television series. So let's jump into it. Lesson one from this book, this is the most important thing, it's the hero's journey. The greatest myths tell a story of courage, sacrifice, and transformation. So let's begin with Joseph Campbell's most important idea of the hero's journey. As we've said, this is a pattern that can be found underneath the world's most powerful stories and myths. And so Joseph Campbell called it a monomyth. It's like one myth that lies beneath so many of the most powerful and long-lasting stories. And once you understand this pattern, then you'll probably begin to see it everywhere. Which is why so many people say that Joseph Campbell changed how they see the world, because they see this pattern everywhere later on. So what exactly is the hero's journey? I'll give you a highly simplified explanation. You can imagine it like a circle, and I'll give you four basic steps of this journey. Step one is the call to adventure. So in the beginning of these stories, the main character is living their ordinary life. That's like Harry Potter, who's living under the stairs in the normal, non-magical world. Or Frodo Baggins in Lord of the Rings, who's enjoying his innocent life in the countryside. Or maybe Luke Skywalker, who's a simple farmer. But suddenly they're called to adventure, called to go on an exciting journey into another type of extraordinary world. And that brings us to step two of the hero's journey, which is trials and tribulations. So then our hero must go on this journey, and on the way they must encounter monsters and slay those monsters, and they meet wise old mentors, like Harry meets Dumbledore, Frodo meets Gandalf, Luke Skywalker meets Obi-Wan Kenobi. Are you starting to see the patterns here? They're all the same character in a way, providing guidance and wisdom to our main hero to overcome those challenges and monsters and evil people. Next, we have step three, the transformation. To succeed in their journey, our hero must endure some kind of challenges, and they must change, both on the outside and on the inside. They must enter dark caves and face their greatest fears. And some of these challenges they face may include Voldemort, Sauron, or Darth Vader. But also inner fears, inner doubts and hesitations that they must learn to overcome, or skills that they must learn to use, like Luke Skywalker learns to use the Force, Harry Potter learns to use magic. So as a result, they experience personal growth and change. And that brings us to the final step four, which is the return. Our hero returns to the ordinary world, but they bring back something new, something of value to their old community. Sometimes it's literally some treasure, but often it's more abstract thing like knowledge or wisdom that they bring back to benefit their whole community. And that is a very brief overview of the hero's journey. Why do these stories that follow the pattern of the hero's journey resonate so deeply with us, no matter our culture, age, or background? Perhaps it's because it applies to our own lives too. These stories show us a pattern that we can follow, by which we can live to have our lives fill with greater meaning and fulfillment. Because when we do leave our zones of comfort, then we'll find things of value, we'll learn something new. We need to learn something new to overcome challenges, and then after we do that, we can bring back things for others in our community to benefit also. Whether it's someone who is just leaving for college to learn skills to enter a career, or whether it's someone who's starting a business, they must really venture into the unknown as an entrepreneur to try to build something that's very risky. In all these cases, we follow that pattern of the hero's journey. Here's a great quote, which comes from a Christian writer named G.K. Chesterton, and this was paraphrased by the popular fiction writer Neil Gaiman recently. He said, "Fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beaten," end quote. And that's exactly how human society has always progressed. Mastering these countless technologies that we have, from fire to agriculture to electricity. It's by heroes of the past courageously exploring things that used to be unknown, and they were following the pattern of the hero's journey. Whether it's the first caveman who decided to play around with fire, figuring out how to control it, or the first people who discovered how to use electricity. So let's summarize lesson one. The hero's journey is a common pattern that lies beneath many of the greatest myths and stories. What is it? The hero is called to adventure. They suffer many great trials and tests, which causes them to become transformed. And then they return to their original world, but bringing something new of value, some treasure or wisdom. And this represents a more abstract spirit of courageous encounter with the unknown. It reveals to us the most meaningful ways that we can live. And that brings us to lesson number two, the religious hero. The central figure in many faiths was also on a hero's journey. So Joseph Campbell reveals in this book that he was raised a Catholic, but from an early age, he became fascinated by myths from other cultures. First, the American Indians, and then Hindu myths, and then others. And he was astonished to find many of the same themes and patterns everywhere he looked, particularly that one we talked about, the hero's journey. Jesus went on a hero's journey. He began with fasting 40 days in the desert and overcoming temptations from the devil. And only after that, he came back to teach his gospel. And by the way, this idea that the Jesus story is similar to other myths, it's not going to be shocking to most religious people. There were very famous Christians in the past, like J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, who were also the famous authors of Lord of the Rings and the Chronicles of Narnia. And after they had reflected deeply on their faith, those men concluded that Jesus' story was like a myth, but it was a true myth, meaning it follows common patterns of powerful myths, while at the same time being historically true. So just to see commonalities between Christianity and other myths doesn't mean somebody sees it as being a false story. They can still be a believer. Okay, let's move on to Buddha. He also went on a journey, sitting beneath a tree. And there he conquered his own mind with all its fears and desires and suffering. And at last he reached a state of inner enlightenment. And then he returned to the ordinary world to share his teachings to help all beings to escape from suffering, as he did. So he went on a journey and brought back wisdom for others. And if you want to learn more about those fundamental teachings of Buddhism, take a look at our summary of the book The Heart of the Buddha's Teachings by Thich Nhat Hanh, famous Buddhist teacher. And also many shamans in native cultures, they also went on a kind of hero's journey. They often began their career, if you can call it that, by going on these difficult spiritual expeditions. And on those expeditions, they maybe endured ordeals, they maybe fasted, they went into the wilderness and had mystical dreams or visions. And as a result of that difficult journey, that put them in touch with deeper universal truths. And after that transformation, the shaman comes back to their community and serves as a mediator between the human world and the divine or spiritual world. So again, it's someone who goes beyond what most people do, and they come back, and that's what gives them the authority to serve as a shaman. Now, for some extra context for what this book is talking about, you should know about the great psychologist Carl Jung. He was actually probably the first one who popularized this idea that there are universal archetypes or patterns that can be found in myths and legends across all these cultures. An archetype, What does that mean? It's like a pattern or an image that's common across many cultures. And Carl Jung believed that these archetypes rise up from the collective unconscious that all of us humans share. And if you don't really get that idea, well, don't worry. There's lots of very smart people are still trying to figure out all that Jung talked about. But in his last book before he died, which was called Man and His Symbols, here's what Carl Jung wrote about this hero figure that's found across many religions and myths. Here's a quote. "The universal hero myth, for example, always refers to a powerful man or god-man who vanquishes evil in the form of dragons, serpents, monsters, demons, and so on, and who liberates his people from destruction and death. The narration or ritual repetition of sacred texts and ceremonies, and the worship of such a figure with dances, music, hymns, prayers, and sacrifices, grip the audience with numinous emotions, as if with magic spells, and exalt the individual to an identification with their hero." End quote. Can read more ideas like that in Carl Jung, particularly in that book, Man and His Symbols. But now let's summarize lesson 2 from this book. At the core of many religions is also the hero figure, someone who endures great trials and sufferings and experiences a transformation, which allows them to bring back a teaching to save humanity. Some examples of this are Jesus, Buddha, and various Native American shamans. And next we come to lesson 3, follow your bliss. Rather than conforming to society, do what makes you come alive. So society conditions us to have certain aims in life. It says, you have to do this, or you should be like that. But often when we follow those social expectations, then we wind up feeling unfulfilled or unhappy. And that's why it's so important to keep asking ourselves questions like, who am I really and what do I really want? At least this is kind of the Western individualist perspective on this, on how we should go about life. But anyway, Joseph Campbell says that to follow your bliss, and this is probably his second most famous idea, follow your bliss. In this book, Joseph Campbell reveals where this idea came from. He was studying Hindu philosophy as a younger man, and he discovered the Sanskrit term Sat Chit Ananda, which is a term for the ultimate reality and also our true self. So in that word, Sat means existence, Chit means consciousness, and Ananda means bliss, Sat Chit Ananda, the route to the ultimate reality or your true self. Now, Joseph Campbell had no idea what those first two words really mean, like existence or consciousness, but he understood bliss very well. He knew when he was feeling bliss, and so he decided to aim his whole life at seeking bliss more and more, which means those experiences when he really felt alive. And he trusted that following this path, following his bliss, could lead him to those other two parts of ultimate realization too. So this became a mantra for his life, and it really stuck with many people who listened to Joseph Campbell later on. Follow your bliss. And this reminds me of another great quote from someone named Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. End quote. So now I'm going to share with you 5 actionable ways that you can follow your bliss. So I've pulled these out of the various chapters of this book. Way number 1 is to sacrifice yourself. So it sounds kind of strange at first, isn't it? We just talked about bliss, but now we're talking about sacrifice, which is usually associated with pain. Well, Joseph Campbell explains that bliss is not the same thing as an easy life. The core principle of being a hero is sacrifice. Sacrificing yourself or some part of ourselves to something larger, whether it's for some ideal, some value, or for the greater good of others. There's something deep inside of us and inside of all humanity that admires the sacrifice that heroes do, whether it's the everyday sacrifices of a mother or father or community leader, or the more dramatic sacrifices of a soldier or firefighter. Here's a quote I like from Ralph Waldo Emerson. "The purpose of life is not to be happy. It is to be useful, to be honorable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well." End quote. So the first route to bliss, and it sounds almost paradoxical, is to find something that is worth sacrificing for. Now, the second way to bliss is to visit sacred spaces. One of Joseph Campbell's favorite places to spend time in was called Chartres Cathedral in a small town in France. And he believes that religious buildings like that are very important. They're not just pretty places to look at, but they're really a landscape of the soul. Perhaps, you know, it goes back to what Carl Jung was talking about, that these mythologies rise up out of our collective unconscious over thousands of years, and then people create these cathedrals to represent them. So when we look around a cathedral or other places of worship, we're really seeing the human soul and a landscape. When we go in there and we observe Jesus on the cross or the paintings of Mary, Mother of God, and the other saints, or perhaps it's providing a glimpse to us of another non-physical reality beyond the material, or that exists alongside the material, a more subjective kind of reality that we all share. Okay, the third way to bliss, and we're going to get a bit more practical here, is to create a private place in your home. Set aside some special place or a specific time, which is reserved for introspection and creative incubation. This time should be free of the daily mundane stuff like news and social media. So one of the best things that you can do in this space is to read great books from authors that are maybe a few steps ahead of you in your life's journey. Campbell says that when we do this, your mind is brought onto that level of those authors, resulting in, quote, a nice, mild, slow-burning rapture all the time. A fourth way to follow your bliss is to pay attention to your dreams. Dreams are private myths, and myths are public dreams, according to Joseph Campbell. What does that mean? Well, they often deliver to us messages of wisdom, but it's coded within kind of symbolic language. So how do we decode those messages in our dreams? Campbell says we can use free association. So when you have a vivid dream that really strikes you as important, then you can analyze the images in those dreams. So explore, through free association, what other memories or ideas are connected to those images in the dream, and keep exploring and connecting to what else it rises up in your mind because of that those images in the dream, and then you'll start to see the message. Now, the next way to follow your bliss is through meditation and prayer. There are certain practices that can help us get in touch with that mystery, often by focusing on one thing. And that singular focus can happen whether we're praying the Catholic Rosary, or we're repeating the names of the God in Sanskrit, or whether we're doing some kind of mindfulness exercise, paying attention to our breath. Campbell says that when we are unified with, quote-unquote, that mystery, then ultimately we will become aware of no forms existing. He seems to be here approaching that Buddhist concept of non-duality, what some Buddhists talk about losing our sense of being separate from everything else. So by really focusing in on a singular thing through meditation and prayer, then we can sort of lose our sensation of being separate forms existing. So that's getting a little bit mystical in language. But I'm going to connect this now to another great author and speaker you've probably heard of named Alan Watts. He's a highly engaging speaker. If you never heard Alan Watts, then definitely search his name on YouTube and listen to some of his clips, because he's so great to listen to. But anyway, during the 1960s, Alan Watts brought many concepts from Eastern philosophy to young Western audiences especially. And in his book, The Way of Zen, he described the unique method of Zen meditation that's known as sitting just to sit, or zazen. Rather than a rigid technique, Zen Buddhists just allow everything to pass by them and pass through them, through their minds. They try to cultivate an inner quality known as non-graspingness. And by doing this, by sitting just to sit and allowing things to pass by our awareness, it can presumably lead to a greater inner liberation from ourself, which they also call our ego, our self. Here's something Alan Watts wrote in that book. It is fundamental to every school of Buddhism that there is no ego, no enduring entity which is the constant subject of our changing experiences. For the ego exists in an abstract sense alone, being an abstraction from memory, somewhat like the illusory circle of fire made by a whirling torch. End quote. So if you're interested in these kinds of ideas and you want to learn more about Zen, definitely go check out our summary of his book, The Way of Zen by Alan Watts on growth.me. Now, I want to reflect for a minute on Joseph Campbell's own positions and beliefs. While he does see this kind of deep value in many religious myths and rituals, he doesn't seem to be a believer himself. In his mid-20s, he left the Catholic faith that he was brought up in. And he says in this book that what is needed for the future is not a return to old ways, but the birth of new planetary myths that can unite all people on the globe. So some kind of new planet-wide myths that can unite everyone together. And he actually saw the United States as being a possible prototype for such a universal myth for the future, as the founders of that country were united under Enlightenment principles like reason, which is even symbolized as the eye of Providence, which is on top of the pyramid, which you can see on the back of every US $1 bill. So, whatever you may think about the United States, it was a country that was founded on these kind of universal principles. So to summarize this lesson, we are raised with certain social expectations, but they often lead us to unhappiness. Instead, Campbell suggests to follow your bliss, meaning do what makes you come alive. Now, that doesn't mean choosing always the easy path in life. Bliss usually involves a path of self-sacrifice, inner reflection or spiritual practices, reading great authors, meditation, prayer, etc. And next we come to lesson 4, becoming an adult. Rituals helped people transition from childhood to adulthood to old age. Why is it that so many young adults today seem to be lacking clear direction? Why are they so often confused about what to do with our lives? Well, perhaps it's because for thousands of years, people were guided through life by myths and rituals, but many of us are losing that. Religious traditions were developed to mark points of transition during our lives, and that made it easier for a person to let go of childhood, to seek where to find meaning in life, and then even to accept aging and approach death with more grace. Here are some concrete examples of these rituals. There were initiation rituals. Many cultures had ceremonies that marked a transition between childhood and adulthood. In many indigenous cultures or tribal societies, there were difficult initiation rituals that involved challenges, including fasting, physical pain, wilderness survivals, real ordeals, so that someone who went through that would come out being a full adult. Now, a toned-down version of an initiation ritual does still exist in modern religious traditions, like the Catholic confirmation or the Jewish bar mitzvah, which happens kind of beginning into the adulthood. But even those are becoming less common in Western countries as they become more secular. And they've been really toned down. In this book, Joseph Campbell clearly says that he doesn't like it when churches try to be more modern and friendly, like using guitar music, or when they stopped using Latin in Catholic masses a few decades ago. He felt many of those changes threw away valuable mystical traditions. Like, the point of those traditions and of religion is to bring us into things that are otherworldly, not to try to appear friendly and current with the times. Okay, another example of rituals were hunting rituals. In many cultures that survived from directly hunting animals, they taught reverence for the creatures they ate. So there were rituals very often associated with the acts of killing, such as giving thanks to the spirit of the animal for its willingness to be a sacrifice. And this would cause those people to view the animals more as equals, equal spirits, as like a thou, not just an it. Later on, when European settlers arrived in North America, they were missing these crucial rituals and perspective, says Joseph Campbell. And perhaps that is what led to mass killings of bison just for their skins. They often left dozens and hundreds of these animals on the fields to rot. So that by 1880, in less than 100 years, the bison population on the continent was decimated, going from tens of millions to fewer than 1,000. So we can see maybe where these rituals were very useful in creating sustainable societies. Okay, another example of rituals is marriage. Here's another tradition that is on the steep decline in the West. Yet Joseph Campbell says there is great spiritual value in marriage. A love affair can be a selfish thing, but marriage is an ordeal because it requires sacrifice of ego, says Joseph Campbell. In other words, it's not supposed to be pleasant all the time. It's often painful to be in a marriage where we have to learn to sacrifice our selfish desires, but we're doing that sacrifice not for the other person, but for the relationship. So it's something in order so that two can become one. And the result is something greater than each person could have individually. It's an experience of real unity. And that public commitment of a marriage ceremony helped many people to endure the ordeal and complete the journey. And by the way, if you're heterosexual, then a book that may be worth looking into and for some more insights into love and relationships and marriage is called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Now, we don't really hear that title anymore today, but it was actually the best-selling nonfiction book of the 1990s. So it made a huge impact on culture and connected with a huge percentage of people. And I think it presents some ideas about how men and women have different needs and relationships that are very relevant today, that many people will continue to find deeply insightful. The author of that book, John Gray, says that most of our conflicts in love come from misunderstanding those gender differences. And I think a lot of his lessons can be summed up in this quote: "Men are motivated when they feel needed, while women are motivated when they feel cherished," end quote. As an example, women will often talk about their upset feelings simply to get a feeling of closeness with their partner, But a common mistake men will make is trying to solve the problem that she's talking about rather than just listening to her. They don't understand the point of talking about the problem. And so if you want to learn more about that, check out our summary of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. But to summarize this lesson, rituals used to guide people throughout life, but much of that is being lost with increased secularization and the losing of the traditions. From the initiation rituals that marked the entry points into adulthood, to even hunting rituals that integrated people with nature, to marriage and other rituals that glued people together in relationships and community. And the next lesson is number 5, The Great Mystery. Symbolic language is a door to understanding unspeakable truths about life. So it's true that Joseph Campbell is not religious in like a traditional sense. He doesn't believe these myths are literally true or like historically true, but views them more like poetry, saying they use symbolic language to communicate very deep truths to us, perhaps even more deeply true than history. But these are truths that are beyond what we're currently able to speak using our rational language. So, to really understand what that means, I think another quote from Carl Jung is appropriate here. He said, "Because there are innumerable things beyond the range of human understanding, we constantly use symbolic terms to represent concepts that we cannot define or fully comprehend. This is one reason why all religions employ symbolic language or images." End quote. We don't really understand the universe and the mystery of it, says Joseph Campbell. Science just labels things, splits things apart, and then labels the parts of it. Like a scientist will look at an atom and then give labels to the different parts of it. But does that mean they really understand it? Do they really know what the energy is that's animating the atoms they're looking at? Or have they simply stuck on a label onto the things they're seeing? I'm reminded, hearing this, of a quote from Albert Einstein, who is often seen as the smartest scientist ever, and he said, "We still do not know 1/1000th of 1% of what nature has revealed to us." End quote. And so with that being said, let's explore some of these key symbols or archetypes that occur in many myths, and what these might signify in being truths about the universe or truths that can guide our lives. So the first symbol is the Mother Goddess, also called the Great Mother. This is a key figure that occurs in many cultures, including the goddess Gaia in ancient Greece, or Isis in ancient Egypt, Kali in Hindu mythology, or even the Virgin Mary in Christianity. The Mother Goddess is the giver of all forms, as in she gives birth to and nourishes all that exists, and in mythology, her body often represents the world. Now, another symbolic thing often found in myths, a pattern, is called the Father Quest. So Joseph Campbell talks about this too. Culture in myths is often represented by a kind of father figure. We can even think of God the Father. And many cultures are centered around this creator God, who's often connected with qualities that most people feel are masculine, like strength, authority, and even warfare. So a common storyline in many myths is someone going on a thing called the Father Quest, such as the Odyssey by Homer, where the hero is told to go find your father. Joseph Campbell says this kind of symbolic quest represents finding your character, who you really are. Now, there's another famous modern figure who talks about religion, psychology, and culture. who's named Jordan Peterson. He's a Canadian professor who's gained the following by taking a stand on the conservative side of a lot of social issues. But for decades before that, he was teaching classes related to mythology at the universities like Toronto and even Harvard. So I want to add a couple of additional points on these symbols from Jordan Peterson's books. First, it's that the Great Mother represents everything that is unknown to us, and the unknown is always both dangerous and promising. It's kind of like that dark cave, which may hold a dangerous animal, or it may have some hidden treasure. So when we see that dark cave, it kind of pulls us towards it with curiosity, but we're also scared, so we have to approach it very cautiously. That is the Great Mother. And then he also talks about the Great Father. That is the known, representing social order, stability, tradition. And the Great Father, culture, it's always both protective and constricting to us. And so society protects us. It regulates us, our behavior and the behavior of other people. But it also can stop us from exploring new potentials and opportunities. And so, you know, so the Great Father, God the Father, it's obviously connected to all kinds of social norms, rules, and taboos. Again, representing the unknown, social order, safety, but also restriction. So in Jordan Peterson's teachings and books, he talks about how the hero is the one who courageously explores the unknown and then transforms it into known. They turn chaos into order. And by doing that, they create a new path that others can then follow. It's like a new pattern of being for others. And that's what makes them a hero. As a imaginary example, imagine the first caveman who figured out how to control fire and use it for warmth and cooking. They transformed an element of the unknown, which is dangerous yet promising, into the known, which is known and beneficial. And by doing so, that caveman made the lives of all their fellow cave people around them better through their courageous action. So if you want to learn more about these kinds of ideas, check out our summary of Jordan Peterson's books, including 12 Rules for Life, or his older book, Maps of Meaning, which is almost like a university textbook on these ideas. But let's return to Joseph Campbell and some more of the symbols and archetypes he talks about. So there are angels and demons. As a child, Joseph Campbell believed, and he was taught, that there were literally an angel on one shoulder and a devil on another, urging him towards good and bad. Now he views them more as metaphors for our inner impulses. You see, inside of us, there is a war. There's always a conflict between different impulses, different powers and principalities that are fighting inside of us. And so it's that hidden subjective dimension of life that we all know about directly. We experience it inside of us, our good and bad fighting it out. So that's represented by those angels and demons. Another common symbol is the serpent. In many cultures, the serpent or snake represents life in its most elemental form. It's eternal regeneration, which is both scary and beautiful. It's life itself. There's a very common religious symbol called the Ouroboros, which is a snake which is eating its own tail. And that represents how all life exists, by eating other life and eternally regenerating. And it is scary and beautiful. It reminds me of a quote that I've heard from Nietzsche, which is that the snake that cannot shed its skin must perish. Though, in the Bible, the snake is rather a symbol of deceit and evil, so it's a little bit different in the way a lot of us have heard about the snake. But there is a similar theme used in agricultural societies and in the Bible, which is kind of like the seed, which must die so that new life can be born of it. And perhaps that seed metaphor even extends to dying and resurrecting gods. See, we can see how all these are connected in some metaphorical sense. Another common symbol in myths is a virgin birth. The most famous and clear example of this is Jesus Christ, of course, being conceived by the Holy Spirit and the Virgin Mary. But there are also many Buddhists who believe that Buddha was conceived in his mother's womb, in Queen Maya's womb, as some kind of divine conception during her dream of a white elephant, so like a spirit kind of entered her in a similar way. And there are various ancient myths that also contain miraculous births, particularly Greek myths, and I think there's an Egyptian one too. Joseph Campbell says the virgin birth represents the birth of spiritual man out of animal man, such as Jesus arriving as the human incarnation of compassion. So it's a higher spiritual form being born within the animal. So to summarize this lesson, we can understand myths better when we view them as speaking to us through symbolic languages and images, not as a primitive form of science, but they're communicating truths that are too slippery to speak right now using literal language. Common symbols include the Mother Goddess as the source of life and the source of all things, forms. There's also the Great Father, which is our culture, representing the unknown, social order and rules, but also tyranny in some cases. There is also the serpent, which is life's eternal regeneration, and virgin births, which symbolize the emergence of the higher spiritual human qualities like compassion. Okay, next we have lesson 6, individualism and love. There was a new personal ideal of love in medieval Europe that caused many greater social changes. Okay, so let's finish up now this book summary with a final idea that appears later on in the book related to the rise of individualistic love. You see, there's this Western ideal of romantic love as being a person-to-person connection with a kind of timeless devotion inspired by the uniqueness of that beloved person. Well, this actually began in the 12th century France with a group called the Troubadours. They were musical poets. So in medieval times, these poets began singing of their love and longing towards a noble woman, a specific noble woman, and all the deeds of courage and chivalry they would do to prove their love to that woman. Before the Troubadours, love was mainly seen as a way to fulfill pragmatic needs. So it wasn't love per se, it was more like marriage fulfilling pragmatic needs. In medieval Europe, the royalty and nobility would often arrange their marriages to cement political power, and people in general saw marriage more as a way to ensure social stability or to rear children, not something that was simply done due to personal feelings of love, as we often portray it today. Now, Joseph Campbell says that change really marked the beginning of a larger shift from collective authority of society to the ultimate validity of personal experience, which is kind of like the individualism which is so dominant in Western cultures today. So Campbell says the beginning of this kind of romantic personal love was a major influence on later social changes, beginning with the legends of King Arthur. So on the surface, these were incredibly popular stories about these honorable knights who met around a round table and went on quests for the Holy Grail. But on a deeper level, they spread this idea throughout society that we ought to pursue our personal ideals and values, in other words, to choose our path in life individually. And later on, there was also the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther was the German monk who founded Protestantism. So that's when that was the big split with the Catholic Church, when all these Protestant new types of churches began, which were based more directly on the Bible. So what was that about? Ultimately, Martin Luther wanted a more direct and personal relationship to Christ, one that was not mediated by the social authority or institution of the Roman Catholic Church. So again, it's a shift from the social authority to personal experience. Joseph Campbell goes so far as calling Martin Luther a troubadour of Christ. And I think this is really a fascinating idea, that a major cause of individualism in the West, as opposed to collectivism, was heavily influenced by these romantic poets who lived in France hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And most of us aren't even aware of it. But, you know, they led to even the source of all romantic comedy movies today. And I want to finally connect this to some ideas from Sigmund Freud, who was perhaps the most influential psychologist that ever lived. So in his book, Civilization and Its Discontents, Freud explains his belief that modern man's unhappiness is often caused by the society in which he lives, because society makes us repress our impulses rather than acting them out, particularly sexual impulses. Now here's where it gets kind of interesting. Sigmund Freud said that society redirects or sublimates our sexual energies towards activities that are more beneficial for society as a whole, such as raising a family, building community relationships, or even doing creative occupations. And perhaps that is why pretty much all past societies of a certain size had these taboos around sexuality, restricting or things like adultery, premarital sex, etc., and punishing the people that did those. You can read more about those ideas in our summary of Civilization and Its Discontents by Sigmund Freud. Now to summarize the last lesson here, the modern ideal of love, of a deep personal connection with that one person, really began or was popularized with 12th century poets called troubadours. They emphasized the validity of personal experience over following of social norms, which was a theme later emphasized again in the King Arthur legends and the Protestant Reformation and in modern Western individualism. So let's finish up now with a few action steps for how we can apply this book to our lives today. Step number one is to recognize the hero's journey pattern. So do you remember at the beginning when I said this book could change how you see everything from now on? Well, don't be surprised when you notice the pattern of the hero's journey the next time you're enjoying a great movie or book. But the most important thing is to consider, how can we live more like that archetypal hero that we so admire, of those stories that we're so captivated by, whether it's Harry Potter or Frodo? Notice how they're always moving towards their problems rather than running away from them. Courageous but cautious action towards the unknown. Okay, a second step we can do is to use the hero's journey in our persuasion or marketing. I don't know if you realize this, but people don't really enjoy trying to be persuaded with facts or arguments. That often feels dry or boring or even manipulative. But what we all love is a good story. That's probably why Jesus usually taught in parables. So remember that a story, a great one, usually involves there being a hero that begins their ordinary life. Then they encounter some unexpected challenge, which requires a transformation. Then they return with something of value. So remember that framework and think about how you can use it the next time you're trying to persuade someone, or whether you're doing some kind of sales pitch or some kind of meeting presentation or even marketing or advertising. It's useful in all those situations to communicate powerfully. The next step we can use is to identify your bliss. So ask, what genuinely excites you or makes you feel alive? That could be a hobby, a certain type of work, or even a cause you believe in. Reflect on what makes you feel happiest and most fulfilled, and try to incorporate more of that into your life and work. Step 4 is to create a sacred space for yourself. This can be a physical location or a specific time where you read inspirational books or simply sit quietly or reflect on your dreams or do practices like meditation, mindfulness, journaling, or prayer. There are many self-help authors like Robin Sharma who recommend doing this first thing in the morning, and perhaps that requires waking up earlier. Another suggestion, step number 5, is to create rituals at home or work. We can use this concept of rituals to create stronger bonds within people in our family or to become better leaders in our organizations. These could be simple daily rituals like eating breakfast together with no smartphones allowed, or maybe a morning team meeting or like a weekly meeting for our family or workplace. Step number 6 is to develop a respect for the resources we use. We can also apply those principles behind the ancient hunting rituals to our own consumption habits. By showing respect and gratitude for the resources that we use, whether that's the food that we're about to eat or the income that we receive, it's a core tenet of a lot of religions, which is praying before a meal and showing gratitude towards whatever God or whatever energy that provided this thing in our lives that we love or appreciate. So even if we're non-religious, that seems to be a good practice to adopt. Okay, I hope you found some value in this book summary, and I'll see you in the next one.